and work session on 2162. I'm just inviting those up. We have not had much discussion except in January. And if I'm going to get started, our other members will be coming in. They had late caucus on the Democrat side, and we had late floor sessions, but I want to get started on this anyway. So bring up the proponents of the bill in the Water Resource Department and get rolling.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the record Martha Cagle, Water Resources Department. We don't want to scare you off by this big panel here, but in part we have invited the panel as a representation of the breadth of interest who have participated on developing the amendments that you have in front of you, the House Bill 2162. You should have in front of you, or be handing out to you, a booklet, which is the report of the Hydroelectric Task Force created by legislation 2 years ago. They've been working very hard during the interim and, in fact, during up to this point of this session to complete the report and prepare recommendations for you, and that's what you should have. I'll also point out that probably delivered to your offices earlier, there was a notebook looking like this. It contains the report that you've been handed, plus some background materials and the statutes and copies of previously prepared reports and information. So we do have that additional background waiting for you. Let me introduce our panel here for you. Sitting next to me here is Dick Bailey. Dick is an administrator in the Water Resources Department, and he's been chairing the task force and the department's representative, key representative on this task force during the interim. Julie Kyle is with PGE, an attorney who has worked very hard on hydroelectric issues for several sessions with us now. We have next to her Bart Brush, who is president of NEDC, Northwest Environmental Defense Center, and representing the various environmental interests who participate in the task force, and then Nathan Gardner, who is chief counsel for Idaho Power. We have just a kind of a brief presentation in mind for you, but let me give you a quick reminder and overview of what we're talking about. This relates to reauthorization of existing hydroelectric facilities, and in particular, most of the attention and focus has been on facilities that are both licensed by the federal government through Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, and under state process, and a lot of effort has gone in to figuring out a state process that was well coordinated with the federal process to minimize duplication and requirements on the applicants, but also to make sure that we have state interests well protected and a good opportunity for participation in the process. That's basically the topic that they've been dealing with. 2 years ago, they brought forward to you House Bill 2119, which was a major overhaul, really created for the first time a comprehensive state reauthorization process. And it included some unfinished business, which led to the creation of this task force and to House Bill 2162. 2119 created this task force with some specific jobs to look at a process for decommissioning, to deal with process for funding and fees, and to deal with whether and how we ought to make some changes in our existing siting process for new facilities based on some of the progress that we've made in dealing with the reauthorization. With that general background, I'll turn it over to Dick to get a better sense of what's in the amendments.
For the record, my name is Dick Bailey. I'm an administrator with the Water Resources Department. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having us here today to talk about 2162. I would like to refer you in your legislative report to the executive summary. And if you take a look on the first page, it talks a little bit about what the bill does. And I'd just like to walk you briefly through that and not get into the more of the complexities of the bill, but just kind of give you a little bit of an overview. The bill adjusts the amount of existing water rights fees. This was done collaboratively with all the members of the task force representing the hydro interests, the environmental interests, and the like, so as to be able to adequately fund the work that needs to be done by the various departments within the state that are associated with hydropower reauthorization. Secondly, the bill proposes a rulemaking. We are proposing that there be a rulemaking within the Water Resources Department under the authority of the Water Resources Commission to address decommissioning of state-licensed, non-FERC licensed hydroelectric projects. Secondary to that, we are recommending that there be a third task force established under this legislation to address decommissioning of projects that are FERC licensed. Thirdly, we have proposed, task force has proposed that there be a provision within the bill that preserves the legal rights of the various interests to address preemption issues between the Federal Power Act and the state authority to license hydroelectric facilities. Fourth, it establishes an in-stream conversion. Basically, the in-stream conversion is there so it's the decommissioning of a hydroelectric facility, but the status quo is maintained in relation to existing water rights so that those people that have been using water from a particular region stream have a known quantity in relation to how that water is going to continue to be used. And it provides some benefit for in-stream values. The recommended legislation corrects some technical errors that were found in House Bill 2119 in regard to notice of intent, how we go about reauthorization, when reauthorization is timed, and the like. And we can certainly answer questions on all these specifics later. That's basically what the bill does. I would say to you that this has been a consensus effort amongst a variety of interests, all of which come here today supporting the bill, I believe. With that, if there's anything the other panel members would like to address to the chair, I'll chair.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Just a question on decommissioning of small hydroelectric projects. Number one, how many are there that are no longer producing power?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's approximately 15 now that are pending decommissioning that are state licensed.
Is the equipment necessary for power production still there? Has that been removed? Is it outmoded? And is this a desired decommissioning?
Mr. Representative, I don't know the specific answer to that. I suspect it's across the board. I know some projects where the generation capability has been removed already. Some where it has not been. So I suspect it's in various stages.
And follow up again.
Oh, yeah, so far it's been voluntary.
I guess, Mr. Chair, the question was, I can see instances where it may have become no longer cost-effective at some point in the future, might be again, and so then they certainly at that point would have the right to go back in, but that's the process. So, but it is voluntary, and the decision is made. Okay.
Atkinson, briefly, your thoughts, opinions about the DASH 2 and DASH 3?
The Chair Representative Atkinson, the DASH 2 amendments are consensus amendments bought off by the task force as a whole after a tremendous amount of work. The DASH 3 amendments is an issue that came up in working with legislative council. The legislative council has some particular views on it. Um,
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, if I can join in on that. The subject matter of the Bastry Amendment relates to what we're referring to as the non-estoppel provision, which basically is offering some protection to the federal licensees or any of the participants who have worked in our task force process and who are participating in the state process but want to reserve their ability at any appropriate point along the way to raise legal arguments regarding whether there might be federal preemption or other constitutional issues. From the state's perspective, all along we've felt that people should have preserved that ability to do it, and we were trying to cover that in what we call this non-estoppel provision. Estoppel relating to the legal premise of estoppel, whether a person can be prohibited from raising arguments because of their past actions. Legislative Council had some concerns about including that type of provision, and I think that Jeanette Holman is here and can address it herself, but they had some concerns that this might set a precedent or allow the inference that if you didn't have this kind of language in other bills, that then you would be estopped, and so Legislative Council is bringing a policy issue to you that is different from the policy that the census group wanted to bring forward to you. We all support the non-estoppel provision and would like to see approval of both the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments. Having said that, I think that there may be, if we had a little more time, we might be able to sit down with Legislative Council and try to work through, and we could certainly, what we'd like to do is keep the bill moving. And if there's a way for us to commit to working with that before it would be heard, for example, on the Senate side, then we could do that. But
does the work group approve the Dash 3?
Yes.
Representative Walsh, yes. It, at least from my perspective as a member of the task force, this is a consensus bill that was crafted as a package, and it's important to us that it go forward as a package.
Did the stakeholders here have their legal counsel with them as they talk the estoppel issue over and resolve it? Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Members of the Committee, I might also point out that we all just received these amendments, and it looks like Legislative Council has done an excellent job in picking up everything that we wanted, and we think that they correlate to what we submitted, but if we find any glitches, we feel confident we can remedy them on the Senate side.
Mr. Chair, if I might add one more comment on this issue.
Please identify yourself.
My name is Mark Rush, the president of the Northwest Environmental Defense Center, NEDC. NEDC had a representative on the task force named Nicole Fardan. The Legislative Council has raised the issue about whether or not this estoppel clause is necessary. In a legal sense, it may not be necessary, but it is necessary for all the task force members to support this bill.
Mr. Chairman,
we're
in
Dash
2 of the estoppel clause.
It's not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it's not in the Dash 2. It's been pulled out, and it's in the Dash 3.
Okay, I'm very confused about this. Hope you can all straighten me out. I thought there was an estoppel clause in the Dash 2, and then the Dash 3 looks like a non-estoppel clause.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, we are seeking a non-estoppel clause. It was not included in the Dash 2, so that your task force is recommending that you adopt both the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 so that we have the Dash 2 plus the non-estoppel clause.
You could probably explain then. I was told that the reason the estoppel clause in there is to enable the federally licensed dams to say that we are willing to be regulated by the state, but we have not foregone the ability to claim federal preemption. Could this be explained or clarified?
I'm Nathan Gardner. I'm an attorney. I'm not the chief counsel. I'm an attorney. The concern, even beginning back with House Bill 2019, was that there was some issue with whether, as far as the constitutionality is about the bill, with the participants deserving the right to challenge that. As it turned out, legal counsel, in reviewing this, discovered the issue of estoppel action on the issue that if participants in the authorization process began participating or continued participation in the process, at some point they may be deemed as the spouse from challenging something.
So the non-estoppel clause enables the federally licensed dams to protest at some other point and say, we want to claim federal preemption.
Right. Rather than being...
Could you please move a little closer to the mic? We need to pick this up for the record, please. Make sure you introduce yourself.
My name is Nathan Gardner. I'm an attorney with Idaho Power Company. Yes, rather than forcing the participants to challenge constitutionality early on or at the very start, this allowed all participants to go forward and try to work things out as they went forward without having to challenge it initially, but at the same time reserving the right to challenge the constitutionality of the bill later on if deemed necessary.
If I may answer that, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, from the state's point of view, this issue did come up 2 years ago as well, and at that time we were able to resolve it by our representations at a hearing like this, that the state's position would be that we want to encourage these federally licensed projects to go ahead and give us a try, go through the state process, and we felt that we would be able to deliver a process and a product that would work for them, recognizing at an appropriate point along the way they may choose to back out and raise the legal argument. And I guess I'm just stressing that we recognize there are timing issues, and we wouldn't say that having gone through the state process and received the state authorization that they could later claim the preemption. But if any point up until that issuance of the state authorization, they could raise a legal argument in a timely fashion, and we would agree with their right to do that.
Sure. Well, if I could add just a point on this, for the record, Julie Kyle from PGE, the issue of coal over hydro dams has been one that's been difficult for the state for many years. One of our projects, Pelton Roundy, was the subject of a Supreme Court case in which we challenged the state's authority to license projects. Our participation in 2119 and in this task force is really an indication that we wanted to find a pragmatic solution that allowed the state to have active and informed participation in the regulation of hydro projects, but without giving up, again, that ability eventually to say, we need a federal license and we're going to rely on that license if we need to.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, before we leave, I just wanted to make sure that the record reflects that we were joined by Jan Lee, who's with the Oregon Water Resources Congress and a representative of the agricultural interests who participated in our group.
Very good.
Thank you.
I'll bring up Jeanette Coleman, Legislative Council.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have with me D.C. Debney, who is a staff attorney in our office, who has also been working on this issue with us. I guess I should explain why I did what I did. I understand the non-estoppel issue, and I understand the proponents of the major wanting to make sure that they can challenge the constitutionality or the preemption, use the preemption argument later on in the process. My concern is with the broad language that deals with in the Dash 2 amendments that says, or as a result of having participated in their drafting, enactment, or implementation. To me, this has amazing effects on all of their legislation in this building.
And you mean the Dash 3?
In the Dash 3s. This implies that any statute that someone works on, the passage, well, it's not even clear whether they participate in favor of or against legislation, but that they participated, if they don't have this provision in their bill, denies them the right to challenge it at a later date. And that's my concern. I think I understand the fees. The cases that we've looked at deal only with a statute that has already been enacted, where someone has availed themselves to a benefit under that statute and then later challenges it. It's purely the legislative process that raises concerns for our office.
I understand. And it does leave a pretty big door open there, but I am not going to form an agreement within the work group, and we'll honor their support for this particular amendment.
Could you clarify to us why since there's not a law that, to my understanding, there's not a statute that says you would be estopped, what was the driving reason that folks still felt they needed the -3 language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I'm probably not the best person. I was not there with their discussions, but my understanding is that their concern is that if they participate in the state process, and they want to, that they can be estopped. And in fact, there are cases where people who have gotten a license or something under the state law have been estopped from challenging that regulatory scheme.
Can be estopped by whom?
By the court.
Interpreting that because of their participation, they were essentially agreeing to the constitutionality, if you will, and therefore foregone their opportunity to protest.
That's correct.
Okay. Would it address your concerns, Jeanette, if this language in -3 had an additional clause which said this language in no way implies that anyone participating in any other process is stopped from carrying a challenge?
Mr. Chair, it would help, Representative Merkley. I'm not sure it would keep every other proponent from coming in and asking for the same kind of language. We use something that you're probably familiar with, maybe at least some of you are familiar with, savings clauses that go in. Well, we have a generally applicable savings clause that says that if any part of a bill is found unconstitutional, the rest of it will be held good. And in many states, a savings clause is attached to every bill for precisely this reason, because it started out as something people were concerned about and became something that they were felt had to be on every bill.
Why do you think they did not have the long run for?
Pardon?
Why do you think they did not want something along that order?
Who? I'm sorry, I don't know.
The workers, why did they want it this broad? I can understand why, but what's your interpretation?
Mr. Chair, I think that their concern is the task force participation of the members of the work group. And so they're trying to get at the pre-enactment of the statutory scheme.
Mr. Chair.
Nothing else.
I saw Mrs. Figel shaking her head, and I gathered from your head that you could, that there have been cases where people have been stopped. This is a legitimate concern.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, for the record, Mr. Figel. My understanding is that there are cases that have found where person has paid fees, for example, that can bar them from then challenging the payment of fees or the need to pay those fees. And that was a particular concern in this case because part of the negotiated agreement that we have here to assist the funding of the project is that these folks basically pay a reauthorization fee up front. And then that helps finance the whole process and the agency participation in it. And then it would be much farther down the road when their legal opportunity to challenge it would come along. So that was a particular issue, that the payment of fees not create an estoppel or that otherwise by having applied for the license that that not create an estoppel. And I believe there are other cases along those lines that if you voluntarily enter into the process, where we might have kind of a difference of opinion is at the point of where the license is actually issued, where, as I was mentioning earlier, the state might at that point say, now you're too far along the line. But clearly, by having entered into the process and paying the fees, we understand the need for protection, and I think we are open to discussion about whether the language of participating in the drafting and accident and the work group part of that needs to be there.
Mr. Chair, I'll support the Dash 3 amendment. I'd also support any additional language that would be helpful if Mr. Coleman wanted to give us a clause to indicate that this is not meant to imply that anything regarding other legislation. I see your reason to think it may not be useful, and I understand your concern about cluttering our books with having to put this in every piece, but it seems to me it's relevant and necessary for this particular procedure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, let me clarify. I wanted the committee to have a chance to look at this separately. It was not into the process or anything. I would be more than willing to work with the work group. I hesitate to say we do this in concept because I think it's an issue that's important to the task force members. But I'd be more than willing to work with them.
Thank you very much.
Other questions?
May I just, in closing, to reiterate that because of the lateness that we were bringing this to you and getting it reaching agreement, we are hoping to keep it moving forward, and we are hoping that you would be able to pass the Dash 2 and Dash 3 with our firm commitment to you that we'll work with legislative council before it's heard on the Senate side.
I was going to suggest that, and we'll take care of it. Thank you. Appreciate that. So we'll just move on. And I'll close hearing on this. House Bill 2162, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2162.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cruz.
I move Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2162.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2162. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Any opposition? Hearing none. So moved.
Mr. Chair. I move the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2162.
Representative Cruz moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2162. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Any opposition? Hearing none. So moved.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I move House Bill 2162 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendations.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2162 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendations. Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Murphy?
Aye.
Morgan?
Aye.
Taylor?
Aye.
Farewell.
Aye. Having required number of votes, House Bill 2162 as amended passes to the floor. I do pass recommendation. Murphy, you want to carry this? Representative Merkley will be our carrier. Thank you very much. We close the work session on House Bill 2162. We open. Let me see. Do we have a member yet on a bill? Okay. Let's go to the top of the list. I don't think so either. Let's go to... Yes. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2838. Let's do that one. Maybe I think you have some amendments here.
Mr. Chair, committee, for the record, Jason Axton, State Representative, District 51. I'm going through all of the complete explanation of where we have been. Here's where we are now. Dash 3 amendments took in the testimony and the questions we had previously, and worked closely with the person to my left from Farm Bureau regarding a way that we'll do this both regionally, equitably, and get the best result. With that, before you ask if any more questions, I would defer to Representative from Farm Bureau.
Thank you, Mr. Schellenberg. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I assume you all have the colored map in front of you, which shows you the different regions. And it, as we worked through it, this made the most sense of anything that we tried as to defining positions so that they would represent both population and geography. As you know, the current makeup of LCDC really is based on population primarily. This brings a geographical equation into it, keeps the population balanced pretty well as it relates to the way the population of the state is really made up. And so we think that in the long run, this is maybe just one small step in regionalization, but we think over the long haul, in time, it's going to be, I don't know if you call it significant, but I think maybe at least significant in the types of decisions that are made by LCDC. And we would support the Dash 3 Amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Schellenberg. All right, questions from the committee? Mr. Rendy, would you like to come up? Or do you want to give testimony 2838? I'll allow you if you want to. Okay. Stay out of this. All right. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Trustee Devlin?
If either of the parties would have this information, the current members of LCDC, do you know where they're from? I mean,
if I understood the question correctly, yes. And I wish Representative Kafoury was here. I would probably help me answer this more specifically. Madras, I'm going to have to go by county. Jefferson, several, Yamhill, Multnomah at this point. I mean, I know that there's Madras, and I know that there is several from what I call Willamette County, Benton County. But again, the intent is in Southern Oregon and Eastern Oregon have been over the years represented and represented very well. In fact, I believe chairman of the board a few times, at least regionally. Again, the intent is regional representation and getting the representation closer to the regions that make the decisions. As you recall from, I think, the first time we started down this route, the congressional district, whereas that is by population, the land use issues are, in my opinion, very drastic from congressional district to congressional district. For that reason, we drew the lines this way. Same amount of, remember, again, recall the original bill added a couple. This is the same number, a little bit more regional.
Mr. Chairman, Don Schellenberg, if I might add to Representative Devlin's question there. There's one, right now there's one representative that represents the brown area, the yellow area, and most of the orange area. Just one representative. This would now have three different people representing that one area. Everything else stays the same. There would still be a requirement that one person be a county, either current elected or past elected county person, and one person be a current or past elected city person. So in all cases, two of these people would be wearing two hats just as they do now.
Okay, other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 Amendment to House Bill 2838.
President Cruz moves the Dash 3 Amendment to House Bill 2838. Any discussion? Any opposition?
I just want to ask, the appointment process is the same.
Correct. Yeah. We didn't change anything. Any opposition? Representative Merkley opposes. Okay, so move.
Mr. Chair.
President Cruz.
I move House Bill 2838 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
President Cruz moves House Bill 2838 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to support this even though it doesn't get to the 36 regions I would prefer.
Thank you, President Cruz. Any other discussion? President Murphy.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I won't be able to support this bill because the residents, I don't believe that the residents of Clackamas, Washington, Yamhill have less than 1/8 the interest in state and the land use policies of the state as residents of other regions of the state. I feel it's a very important set of issues for everyone who lives here. I would support a strategy in which we had additional representatives from the five congressional districts so that within a very diverse congressional district there could be two significantly different points of view, which would still leave every citizen with a fair and even representation, but to cede to some citizens 8 times the power of other citizens seems to me fundamentally contrary to the very nature of democracy in our state, and I can't support this bill.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman,
population
is smaller in those areas. Thank you.
Thank you. Clerk, please call the roll.
Is there a second?
Aye.
Is there a second?
Aye.
Is there a deadline?
No.
Is there a Kikori?
I can go to
Is it Murphy?
No.
Is it Morgan?
Aye.
Is it Taylor?
Aye.
Farewell.
Aye. Having the required number of votes, House Bill 2838 as amended.
She's called my name.
Yes.
Did she call my name?
I could do this.
Oh, she did. Maybe I
should. Maybe. Do you have Representative Gino?
Okay. I must be okay. I am
okay. Having House Bill 2838 as amended to the floor with the House recommendation. We close the work session on 2838 and session Lewis. Atkinson will carry.
Thank you. Thank you, colleagues.
You want 2865, Representative Lewis? Okay. Let's open a, because we still have work to do on 2865. Let's open a work session on, well, we're going to just talk about this. It'll be a hearing on 3456. Representative Lewis.
That's a pretty neat number, 3456.
Yeah. 3456. How did you get that?
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm Leslie Lewis. I'm the state representative of District 29, and I have come before you today to talk about House Bill 3456. As many of you may know, I have had the pleasure of chairing the Environment Energy Committee in the 95 and 97 sessions, and one of the issues that we have worked on in that committee over that time that I was chair was issues revolving around cleanup and independent cleanups that businesses can do to clean up potential pollution problems that they have in their factories. House Bill 3456 comes to you from Associated Oregon Industries. During the interim between 95 and 97, I became aware from constituents of mine and other people around the state that there was a problem with what is called the voluntary cleanup program. And I wanted to address this in the 97 session, and I was told by AOI at the time that, well, they were in various work groups with DEQ and that they thought that the issue could be worked out. And so we did not work on this during the 97 session. But I will tell you what has happened since the 97 session is those ongoing issues have still not been able to be worked out. and we do need to reform the cleanup program that DEQ makes available on a voluntary or an independent basis. One of the major problems with the cleanup program, because businesses know that the experience of fellow businesses is that once you get into voluntary cleanup, there is not an exit strategy. There's not a way to get out of the voluntary cleanup program. DEQ makes it very difficult to get to the stage where you get what's called a no further action letter. And because those problems exist, businesses are not willing to come into the cleanup program, and we would like them to come into the voluntary cleanup program or the independent cleanup program. So House Bill 3456 is designed to address that issue, and I believe that what I think would work, Mr. Chair, is if you would appoint a work group of members of legislators from this committee to work with DEQ and Associated Oregon Industries. I have found that has worked for me in the past on some environmental bills that I have worked on, and I would encourage the chair to do that. I believe this is good legislation and that a compromise can be worked out between DEQ and industry, because the goal should be a win-win situation for everyone, which is to get these cleanups occurring, and the current system is a barrier to that.
Very good.
Thank you.
Lewis, I appreciate that, and I will take your recommendations here. I want to open up if there's any questions from the committee for you at the moment. Any questions?
I just wanted to ask, it was my understanding that AOI had in fact worked on this measure and tried to make it accessible. It was DEQ.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, there has been some work done, but they have not reached agreement. And sometimes the work group process is the way to do that. And I'm suggesting that if the chair is amenable, I have found that to work very well. Have a work group that has the interested parties, plus some legislators who are members of the committee. And I think that would work. I think that would serve to work out the final remaining issues between DEQ and AOI.
And I agree. I'm very serious about this bill, and I would like to get it as quickly as possible. So I want to appoint a work group here. A couple of our members. I'm not sure that Representative Kapori not being here. I have not talked to her. I'd like her to serve on that possibly, along with Rep. Cruz. And he has already said he would like to do that. So,
and Chair, if it would be all right, I would attend some of those meetings.
As you have time?
As I have time.
Representative Lewis also.
Okay. Yeah. While you're doing that, I could do some budgets for you. It'd work out.
See how much help you have here?
That's great. I love it.
And I'm sitting on some of that budget process, too, for you. Okay. And I direct, of course, AOI sponsor the bill and DEQ certainly to be there. I'm leaving it open to others here that I'm sure have an interest also to be on that work group. And we want to get started as quickly as possible, because I do want this, I'd like to have it within the next 2 weeks here, if we could possibly work that out so we could get this moving. Let me finish one little thing here. We need clear criteria for when a person gets a no further action letter. It should be based on results, how it really exists, and not processed. You get a lot involved in regulation, enforcement, and everything else that is all processed, and we forget about results, and we want results out there. And we need a good, clear appeals process that will give people confidence before they get into discussion with the DEQ, that they will be treated impartially here. So those are some of the things that I want to make sure that occurs in our discussions here. Okay, let's make sure.
Excuse me, Chair, can I interrupt?
That's fine.
I told Randy Tucker, 1,000 Friends, that I would present his testimony, and perhaps the work group will find it interesting. So,
that's
for the rest of us.
Very good. Thank you. And in the interest of time and having a work group, we'll just press on. I know I'm going to ask Chair of Energy and Environment to lead out in this, and she wanted to participate in. So I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. Mr. Chair, may I ask on 2865, I know there is ongoing work on that. It's just going to be set over for another time. Thank you very much.
Yes, that may be later in the week or the following week. All right, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3456. And we will open a hearing on House Bill 2885. Open a work session on House Bill 2885. If I have, do I have amendments on that yet? I'm not sure. That was kind of a good. And 2885 is essentially the gut and stuff. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2885, and I'll explain my amendments on this particular bill. We were wanting to address the situation that occurs out on forest land, acreages of 80 acres, some smaller, some larger. We have a dwelling on those acreages. We have a party that has bought those for forest land management. And they do not want to change the use of the land. They don't want to also be a landowner, a renter of the property. And so they would like to be able to carve out that house and property around the house without having to destroy those places. So sometimes they are, because they don't want to be in the housing management business, that they will sometimes destroy those. And they've already been allowed out there. So what we'd like to be able to do in this bill, a dash one amendment that are gotten set for 2885, as I see, do take care of that if we have eliminated the remaining parcel, which is part of 4S215780, as I understand. And I would bring up the department to take, if they want to give testimony on this. Mr. Rennie, do you want to come on up? We had, I think, this issue before. Talk a little bit about it.
Mr. Chair, Bob Rennie with the Department of Land Conservation Development. I don't recall testifying this session on the bill.
I do
recall previously, and I'm trying to understand the dash one amendments. And if I'm understanding them correctly, what they do is that they authorize a dwelling on the remaining parcel.
Well, we didn't want to authorize it on the remaining parcel, being that which is that was cut out, is what it's supposed to indicate, not being able to allow any more dwellings on the less than 80 acres or the remaining dwellings, because as I understand it under that 215, that I understand that will, because of the use that is, and EFU use, that there won't be a dwelling allowed on that anyway, under standing regulations.
So that
if it's not saying what I'm wanting to say here, how do you read this?
Mr. Chair, Forest Center, Kevin Birch from the Department of Forestry. The situation that you're describing is, as I understand how the current law is, that a lot of timber managers don't want to be renters, don't want to manage land. The provisions in this law came out of a bill that was introduced in 95, and it was the intent of that bill to allow a timber owner to break a 5-acre parcel off of the remaining parcel if it was a large parcel, and met the minimum requirements. And the one piece that was attached to that was that the remaining parcel, the newly created parcel without the dwelling, if you will, was then not eligible for an additional dwelling, so that you didn't end up with a proliferation of dwellings.
Right.
You really did end up with a situation where the landowner wanted to manage for timber but did not want to manage for residential purposes. As I read the amendments to this bill, that would cancel out and allow this amendment, as I read it, would allow an additional dwelling on that acreage that is broken off.
Well, then that's not... I need to get further work on that if it's not doing what I wanted to do because it doesn't sound like it. So I'll get further explanation on this before we go forward.
If I could clarify, Mr. Chair, your intent would be to allow a relative or a person,
no.
Is it not a hard to case anymore?
No, not on that.
Okay.
Particular bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I understand the intent, the bill right now, I think current law allows the small piece that already has a dwelling to be divided off and to be sold off, and the timber manager would then have a fairly large piece that's just forest land with no dwelling. And I also, at least I don't know if this is the intent, but I am concerned that it seems like the way this is drafted that it would allow that larger piece to then have a new dwelling, and our concern would be you could have a sort of a rolling situation,
yeah,
where that's been eligible for the...
Let me go further from the definition from the petition on this, okay? And we'll go further with that later, okay? Because I don't think it's... After I read this too, looked at it, I'm not sure that's what we want to do, so... That's the GML.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, on the -1 amendment, page 4, line 1, will not in the future complain about accepted farming or forest practices. Do we need to clarify what complain means? Or is that
it? Yeah, that was right. That's part of the present law under 215.780, and I think that was, may have come out of the right to farm.
Okay.
Act 3116 of 1993 or something along there. I think that's what that was. Okay, let's close the work session on 2885. And we'll open a work session on the House Bill. Let's see. What's the jacket was going to be here? I'll wait for you to go there. Let's open a work session on House Bill 3410. Oh, hold it. I got rest of me. Sorry about it. 3359. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get those straight in the way I want to come on.
My drink is getting strong.
If you got them now.
Well, you talked about it, yeah, you have, but I won't worry about it. Let's go ahead with House Bill 3259. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3259, then we'll go to 3410. I understand we do have some amendments that are being presented on 3259. John Tamler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the risk of abusing the committee's patience, there are the -1 amendments of House Bill 3259. Unless that's more than a tax of the stupids, the -1 amendments gut House Bill 3259 and replace it, which was not the intention. They are supposed to be added to House Bill 3259. I just put a call in with the council to ask him to come down here quick like a bunny. So I'm not sure what. I think we could do a conceptual amendment in the committee, if you'll accept that, to fix it. It's merely a question of where we add these -1 amendments to the bill in chief.
The -2 is on the council.
I'm here speaking only on the -1s,
okay.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm not sure who brought the -2.
Oh, that was Star Leisure. And that's not. Okay. And that's been started. Those were not. Dash 2s were not needed.
They're in the one.
Might be in the one.
And so, if you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Recommendation. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Do bunnies run in circles?
Oftentimes, Mr. Recommendation.
Is that the best analogy to use while waiting for amendment?
We could toss cards in the hat as well. That's also a good analogy.
So we
heard of the committee's wishes.
We are promised that somebody from the legislative council is coming down.
Well, I did make that request.
Okay. Yeah. Why don't we move? I'll let Pat go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pat Egan, representing Beaverton and Hillsborough School District. We did make the request through Representative Decker's office to draft amendments to 3259 in addition to, they were not to supplant or replace the bill. So we're well with him.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah,
I just advised my committee staff that I have, in fact, more than a pack of the stupids, and this is the amendments to what we've asked them to do.
Not with that.
It's Friday of a hell of a week.
On the record, Pat Egan is not with John G.
Mr. Chair, for the record also, that's kind of the way Chandler umpired the game last night, too.
Oh, that way we know.
Absolutely, Murphy's ball was foul. That's all there was to it. Mr. Chairman, I'm advised by committee staff, and I appreciate this very much, the way this council does this. If you look on page 3 of the actual amendments, they add the in line 4, delete 1, and insert 5. What they've done is turn section 1 of the printed bill into section 5 of the dash 1, which was news to me, and that's not the way I would have written it, but they didn't ask me. So, with that little circular running, Mr. Chairman, I was glad to tell you what we're trying to accomplish.
Probably right about now, we could find you a job at LC.
Mr. Chair, I need a review of the whole.
You want
to? I just need a little
improvement.
Yeah.
Okay, Resident Taylor. Mr. Chairman, would you like to do that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to. For the record, John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association. What we're attempting to do here with House Bill 3259 is to make it possible to site schools in urban reserve areas. Urban reserve areas are areas outside of the growth boundaries, which the jurisdiction has designated for future urban growth. There's a specific procedure set forth in Oregon law for the creation of urban reserve areas. You have to follow a very technical process. You have to do all the balancing under the goals. You have to make sure that you've weighed all the various ag and forest protections and so on. And then once they are established, once an urban reserve is established by a local government, the jurisdiction, when they're going to move the urban growth boundary, is charged by state law to look first at urban reserve areas. So that's what this bill will do, is allow schools to be located in those areas. Currently, schools can be located outside urban growth boundaries, but only if they serve a rural population, not an urban population. And the reason we're bringing this bill forward on behalf of, together with the Beaverton and Hillsborough School District, is that in the metro area, at least, land is very expensive. And if you're talking inside the urban growth boundary within the Beaverton School District, for example, if you could find an appropriately sized parcel, which is difficult, you'd be talking somewhere in the neighborhood of $150,000 to $200,000 an acre. If you could locate that same school outside the urban growth boundary, you're probably in the $10,000 to $15,000 an acre range. So, and this would be an area where urban growth is going to occur when the boundary moves. So it will not, as a $10,000 urban reserve, not at that point, it's not EFU protected land. It is land going to be set aside for future urban use.
But it is defined as urban reserve and on the record.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
I have a little feeling of deja vu about Representative Williams' bill, which we talked about, mm-hmm. which was kind of similar. And is it the same?
No. This bill is limited to urban reserve areas. If I remember correctly, Representative Williams' bill, that was the one you heard last week, dealt with schools and EFU generally.
Okay.
Outside the urban growth boundary generally. Mm-hmm. And it sounds a little more confusing, and perhaps I'm not making myself clear. There's a provision in state law that local governments may designate urban reserves. There's no requirement to do so, but they may designate them. And when they've done that, as I said, they have to go through a very complicated process. That then becomes the area into which UGB for that jurisdiction will expand when and if that becomes necessary. And it was designed, when the Urban Reserve Rule was written back in the early 90s, to provide a transitional area, basically, between urban use and rural. So it was in urban reserve areas, for example, parcelization is restricted, or can be. Placement of buildings on the property can be restricted so that future urban use won't be complicated by having a parcelized pattern. This bill would only apply to those specially designated areas.
I wonder if the same argument that we heard last week would apply, though, that schools are an urban use and therefore should not be sited outside the boundary. I'd like to hear some comment maybe from DLCD or others on that.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chairman, if I may, and I'll certainly defer to the DLCD on this issue as well. The reason we drafted the bill to apply only to urban reserve areas was simply because of that. These are areas that by definition adjoin the urban growth boundaries. A jurisdiction is not about an urban reserve out the way, but about one that's immediately adjacent to, and it is the area into which the urban growth boundary will expand. So basically what we're trying to do is, at the very most rudimentary level, is we're attempting to let schools purchase land at wholesale as opposed to retail prices, purchase land and locate schools. It's a way of getting needed school facilities where the growth is going to occur before it costs them five times more money. And the reason we limited to urban reserve areas was, again, because of the restriction on urban versus rural uses. We wanted to make it clear that these were obviously going to be urban uses, but within an area that, if not urbanized today, would be urbanized through the plan of the local government.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Thank you for hearing me. So I just wanted to give a 15 or 20 minute review of my school district and my involvement in it, and just for a refresher for the committee.
Mr. Chair,
thank you so much.
And also, when you're going to graduate would be helpful.
Mr. Chair,
this committee, I should have warned you as you came in.
I should have known.
Yeah.
That,
we should also warn the good representative, Mr. Chair, that we have a history of throwing paper ones at people.
Yeah, at some point in time, and then he was ready to get them, wasn't he?
Yeah, I know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, can you, move that into about 20 seconds?
Mr. Chair, I would be glad to. And just to be on point with Representative Taylor's question, we have in Beaverton specific examples where we need within the buildable lands within inside the UGB on urban reserves, we have issues of where we have just schools within areas that are over at capacity, and we're looking for urban reserve land that we could locate a school, and this would just be a nice little step to achieve that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
How many places around the metro area do we have? How many?
How many urban reserve areas?
Yeah, how many possibilities do we have for schools? I mean, the way we're growing right there, there's got to be quite an issue around all around Portland.
Well, Mr. Chairman, at the moment, we don't have any urban reserve areas. The Metro Regional Government designated numbers of sites, but they're all on appeal. LUBA didn't care for how Metro did. The case was going up to the Court of Appeals. So at the moment, there are none. There are other jurisdictions on the state, I believe, which have designated urban reserve areas. I don't know where or how many acres.
Mr. Chair, if I could say one thing on that point, because I think that is the biggest question facing suburban fast-growing districts in the state, and it's a huge issue because there's no mechanism for capital construction within our state school funding, which is a different issue. But the real conundrum that we find ourselves in is that you have schools in over capacity, and they're having to bus students way, way across town in Beaverton and Hillsboro, and I believe in Tigard also, because of this issue, and this bill will at least help on the margins to address that.
Appreciate that.
I have a question on the dash one on the first page, line 8, where it notes the plan may provide for establishing or setting urban services from inside an urban growth boundary to an area in a county outside the urban growth boundary. In this clause, it doesn't specifically refer to the urban reserve, and it sounds like it's opening the door to any area. Is that be clarified why it has been written in this fashion?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley,
I think what we have here, Senator Sutub had introduced the bill, Senate Bill 501, that we had asked to be introduced as an amendment to 3259, basically as an addition to, and this is the language from that bill, Senate Bill 501. We would not have a problem with making a clarification there to limit it to the scope of 3259 and urban reserves. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
I'm wondering, because it does address urban reserve in the original bill, if that sufficiently covers it, and this is just a reference to services provided once the siting has happened.
We'll run past the department here, too, real quick. That's an important. Also, in regard to dash 1, line 10, where it refers to a school or other educational facility, is there a definition in the statute for other educational facility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I'm actually glad you asked that question. I just handed the committee staff some possible conceptual amendments if the committee is willing to accept them. We were approached by Farm Bureau and the counties directly before the hearing today, and they would like clarification as well. And our suggestion is to insert on line 10, actually first to delete a school or other educational facility, and I'd like to run this past the wiser brains of my own first, but and then to insert uses permitted by ORS 215, 213, 1A, and 215, 283, 1A. Both of those are the references to the ability to site a school, public or private, in DFU.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Another question. If a school district says we would like to put a school in the urban reserve, is the county under obligation to provide services? I'm reading this as an option. The county may choose to do this. Is that correct? Or if the school district decides they'd like to do it, does the county need to provide services?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, my belief here is that without some affirmative language allowing the extension of services through a comprehensive plan, it's conceivable that you could cite a school and then not have the services extended, water, sewer, those other services. What we were attempting to do was to make sure that those services could be provided or could be extended through the comprehensive plan. And so you're right, the may might potentially be a problem there.
Actually, Mr. Marzan, mostly the siting of any facility outside, in this case, the schools in their reserve, the county is permitted under this bill to run services. It doesn't have to if they can't reach an agreement with the school district over payment for those facilities. It puts no under obligation on the county to do this for free. The school district would have to negotiate with the county both for the location within the urban reserve and for the running of services and the payment for those services.
They still have to negotiate with the county before this ever happens.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. All this bill does is allow something to occur which is currently prohibited. It doesn't mandate it, and it certainly doesn't say that they would have to go to the siting requirements, all the same land use issues with the county that would exist currently.
In House Bill 3259, first page, section starting on line 18, this section has been altered from a negative to an affirmative. As far as I can tell, it does roughly the same thing as it did in the original version, but what is the reason for that this doesn't apply to schools?
Mr. Chairman, actually, that, I believe, and this has happened on several bills I've had this session, legislative council occasionally takes the opportunity of a bill to make grammatical changes in the statute. We did not ask for the language there. I believe it simply is a rewording of the current law to make it more in line with their form book. I looked at that myself in the first draft bill, and I tried to figure out how clever I'd gotten it, but I hadn't gotten clever at all. It simply was a rewording.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just speak to the original part of the bill? What always worries me is to see those two prohibiting clauses. The local government is prohibited from passing anything that would prohibit siting a single-family dwelling. Could you just speak speak to that. If it were otherwise allowed, just give me an example. I just, if the sighting would otherwise have been allowed, what does this do? It allows the sighting now. It would compel the local government to allow single-family dwellings in the urban reserve area.
Mr. Taylor, no. And again, I think what's happening on lines 18 to 21 is simply a retooling. This is not our language. Let council do this on their own nickel. I'm guessing as to what their motivation was. It's simply grammatical. But the way they're wording this, shall not prohibit, they mean they shall not prohibit. They can't, if it's legal, otherwise illegal, they can allow it. It doesn't mean they have to. They still have, I think what I recall when this was put in, it was addressed the issue of the separate creation of an urban reserve and whether or not that affected law of record. But again, this is not our language. It's a retool by Lex Council.
So the only intent of your measure at this time is school signing?
Yes, ma'am. Our amendment is the dark language of Representative Taylor on lines 22 and 23. For example, insure with an I has been changed to ensure with an E on lines 5 and 25, and I'm not sure what the distinction is, but I'm sure there is one, and there's a good reason for them to do it.
So it's usher with an A, I shouldn't. What's the I just want to reiterate an author's intent is to use just that what Representative Taylor spoke.
One concern I've heard raised is that in general urban reserve areas are not locked in. That is that the local planning area can decide, well, we designated that as urban reserve 10 years ago, but now we really see that we want to do this other area for whatever policy reason might exist, and that this change in law will probably make it, once the school decided, there really won't be any flexibility. Have you heard this concern? Do you have any thoughts about it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, I've heard the concern, and I think it's somewhat misplaced. Urban Reserve, the authority to urban reserve was only created about, I think, 6 years ago, 6-7 years ago. Not that many jurisdictions have done them in the first place. The Metro has done the biggest job of identifying them. They are on appeal, so we don't have them, at least in the Metro area right now. And the notion that somehow we're going to do a bunch of baiting and switching is prospective, if at all, and I think would require, to designate an urban reserve, you have to go through the LCDC process of all the balancing, basically almost the same test as an urban growth boundary expansion in terms of the seven factors and the location and preservation of farm and forest land, all of that. I find it impossible to think that a jurisdiction would do that and then decide afterwards, oops, that wasn't very smart, let's go do it someplace else. I think the process of designating urban reserve is rigorous enough that when we're done, we can be safely assured that that is the direction into which these are going to go. I might mention, Mr. Chairman, I spoke with Representative Devlin, and I don't know if he will be coming back to the hearing or not, and we discussed just conceptually the idea of adding language, and I wouldn't propose a conceptual now because I don't have the language that he was talking about in mind, to make it clear that it had to be an acknowledged urban reserve through the LCDC process, which was implicit, I believe, in the drafting of the bill, which I think that he didn't indicate one way or the other whether that'd make him backwards over the bill or not, but he certainly indicated that'd make him more comfortable, and we're happy to do that when it gets over to the Senate, and I think that would address your point as well.
Well, we could do it here conceptually, too.
If Reverend Devlin comes back, we have to do that.
We could wait. Yes, we could, but we're also going to have the department come out and talk about it, too. So. Any further comments here?
Mr. Chair, just real briefly here, to Representative Merkley's earlier point about narrowing the dash ones only to urban reserves, on line 8 there, after urban growth boundary 2, we might insert an urban reserve area. That's what we narrow it.
Three comments.
Any other questions? Any members?
Well, that's the comment.
Mr. Chairman, for Representative Deckard, I'd just like to congratulate you on being the youngest representative, and I think it's an honor.
Well, thank you very much. I hope you tell my good friend from Rose.
It was done in a good-hearted way.
How are you?
He's a printer.
Mr. Wendy. Thank
you for her. Cool story.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Rindy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm with the Department of Land Conservation Development. I earlier turned in, about a little while ago, some written comments. I wonder if those have been handed out to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're still back in the desk, if I do have some written comments. Do you have those? I know they're on the table, but I don't think you handed them to the manager. I was the staff person at DLCD involved in the rulemaking maybe 6 or 7 years ago when we were asked by local governments to create the possibility for an urban reserve as a new planning tool. And our concern then, and our concern today especially, is that because it's got the word urban in it, it's not an urban growth boundary. It is something very much different. An urban reserve is an area that is from 10 to 30 years beyond the 20-year supply that all urban growth boundaries must have. So if you look at the metro area, for example, when they do finally have their urban reserves, it won't be this way, but they at least have the authorization to ultimately have a 50-year growth line around that boundary. That is a lot of land, and most of it is farmland. And all the parties that sat in those hearings and worked on this and in the work groups for urban reserves, everybody was of agreement that urban reserves are not urban growth boundaries. That's still farmland. It's still protected in the same way that farmland is protected. Farmers out there still intend to treat that and use that in the same manner as if it was outside an urban reserve area. And that's our concern with this bill. It does start to blur that distinction between urban reserves and urban growth boundaries. Urban reserves are not supposed to have urban uses. And if we establish schools and other urban uses in urban reserves, that has the effect of making decisions about where urban facilities are going to go long before the local government has made those decisions. School districts will collect land. It probably would be farmland and urban reserves. And because of their site selection process, you would then have a large facility with sewer and water service, as I read the Dash 1 amendments, and a decision has been made for an area that might be 40 or 50 years into the future. That decision is, especially when you start extending sewer lines, that decision is going to then have ramifications for the planning of that urban area for decades. And the local government didn't make those decisions. Local governments generally, for the urban growth boundary, sit down, they look at the whole thing, and they say, where's the most efficient place to put sewer lines? Where's the most efficient place for our urbanization to go? How do we finance those and put those public facilities in there? And they make that decision based on which basin is most efficient, where the growth ought to go. The concern that we've always had in land use process and why we came up with urban reserves is local governments would like to be able to do that, and rather than have random decisions such as the school board saying we want to go over here, start to make decisions that will lead to urbanization to an area that the city may not have intended for some time. Schools are magnets, and especially when they have urban facilities provided to them. Other uses, commercial uses, ultimately residential uses, will tend to grow around them, and that kind of pattern has been what's occurred in the past. So with that, I'll be glad to answer questions.
But, Mr. Lindy, also, on the other hand, sir, being a taxpayer, I'm very concerned that when I start paying for property for schools, that I get the best deal I can.
Mr. Chair, the state picks up the tab for transportation costs to school. So for all the busing that happens, the state is paying a large percentage of that tab. The further out a school is from an urban area, the higher cost to you as a taxpayer. The school district doesn't see those costs because the state picks them up when they evaluate a site in and around existing development on a site way out of the boundary out in farmland. That ledger doesn't show those transportation costs because they're going to be paid here regardless. And it might look to the district like that's a cheaper site, but in the long run, if they were paying those transportation costs, that would be a much more expensive site. We're paying those transportation costs if they're sticking them up.
We know that. Those numbers wrong.
I can't give them to you today, but I have seen some examples run, and I can provide those to you. They're hypothetical about, you know, presuming it's a certain distance and something like that.
Mr. Chair, I would disagree. The state doesn't pay the transportation costs in Beggars Point to make it a portion, but it's certainly not all of it.
Okay, Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, despite this having been designated as urban reserve, it still is exclusive farm use.
Correct.
Property. And the same as the measure we heard last week, essentially, which would have allowed siting of schools on exclusive farm use, which I believe the Farm Bureau opposed, if I recall. I kind of get these measures confused on
Friday afternoon. Right. We do have about four of them that are working out in the same areas here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, that's correct. It would allow on siting on EFU. I don't know whether the Farm Bureau's position is different on this bill, but we were trying to point out that it's essentially the same issue. This will allow that farmland to be converted for school.
Mr. Remy, I've just got one copy here. Dick Benner, Director Benner's comments on 3259?
Yes, April 30.
April 30, yeah. I only got one copy here. Does anybody else have a copy of it?
Okay.
Well, it won't go on the record because I don't have copies for everyone here in the right number.
Mr. Chair, I handed the multiple copies to the assistant about 15 minutes ago during Mr. Chandler's testimony and asked that it be handed out. I had the correct number. And I think those went back on the table. There may still be many back there, but I didn't see them come around to you.
Mr. Chair, is April 9th?
No. April 30th.
Oh, no,
I don't have it. April
30th. But I did turn.
Do we have a whole stack of them over on the table? We don't. Yeah, we need to make sure as soon as we come up, if you have those, please then hand them to our staff so we do get them and don't do anything else other than that. Yes, that is it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. I thought that was the place to hand them, but I'll amend that procedure.
Okay. Now we're done. Morgan.
You've been talking about the lack of a process to establish services to a school that was sited in an urban reserve, but there's kind of a process described in here that does that. What about it that doesn't meet your needs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I don't think it doesn't meet our needs. I was just trying to point out that it would likely be the case that the process to pick a school site and then as an afterthought probably usually to run a sewer line or a water line out of the urban growth boundary into that area would be a whole lot different than if the city public works department was planning a sewer system for the urban area and picking various basins that they would serve what sequence they would run their services and how they might finance those. Those are wholly different processes.
May I have a follow-up?
Yes.
I have only a recollection of what the urban reserve area looks like for Portland, but my recollection is that it's just pieces kind of on the edge of the urban growth boundary, and that it would seem to me that planning on how the urban services should go into those kinds of areas would be a process that could be followed through quite reasonably by the plans that were already in place for the land that went up to the urban growth boundaries. And it just doesn't seem like that much of a stretch to me that the service provision part of this is going to go that far astray.
Mr. Sheriff Morgan, it wouldn't necessarily, but I think you have to think about all that. Any city can establish an urban growth boundary. And for the most part, the urban reserve, since it's a 10 to 30 year supply beyond that urban growth boundary, the urban growth boundary, you can think of it as a donut of developable land, and it's going to take 20 years to fill all that land in. So the urban reserve is another donut, if you will, around that one. From the existing developed area, what this authorizes is leapfrogging over that 20-year supply of vacant land out into another ring, 10 to 15 years even beyond, 30 years beyond that, and establishing and allowing the authorization of schools and services. In some cases in the metro area, that may not be a big stretch. There may be urbanization right up into the boundary of various places in the metro area. But in other cities, and even in portions of the metro area, there's a great deal of distance between the urbanized pattern today and the edge of that boundary. It's a long way till the city will go out there. So what this is saying is you may go beyond even that into an area that 30 to 50 years wasn't expected to be developed for 30 to 50 years. It's unlikely that public facility service planning will have been done for an area that far in the future.
That sounds great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple points. First of all, the urban growth boundary, the 20-year buildable land supply is a guess at best, and it's readjusted all the time. So, that's kind of, in my opinion, a total smokescreen, but your response to Representative Morgan's question two questions ago kind of assumed that a school district's just going to go out there and say, well, gee, we like this piece of land, let's start a school here, and then we're going to go see what we can do to hook things up. And that's not what's going to happen. What's going to happen is it's going to be done in a collaborative, thoughtful process. I've been involved with my school district and the way they do things, and they talk to everybody. You know, they determine where growth is going to be. They determine where need is going to be, and that's what happens. So to say that this is a disconnected process, I don't think really speaks. It's almost demeaning the intelligence of school districts in their planning to say that's what they're going to do.
Mr. Sheriff and crew, I certainly didn't intend to imply that districts wouldn't think of these things, but my point was that the process that a school district uses to decide if a site will work for their district and if they can get services is not the same process that the City Planning and Public Works Department would use to determine where and when services ought to be extended to rural land. And so whenever you authorize any sort of major urban use outside of an urban growth boundary, such as a school, it could be any other number of uses, and then realize that whatever processes, and they might be very irrational, whatever processes draw services out to those areas, that what you're really doing is you're leading the growth of the city. Many cities, when they came to LCDC in the early 80s with their comprehensive plans and with the urban growth boundaries that they had drawn, they told us that the reason they drew the boundary here is there was already sewer lines out here, or there were already schools out here. And so we know from past experience that those things tend to lead growth.
They do, but aren't they leading them in the right direction, the direction that you want to go? What's the criteria that you have established to make a decision, that you will follow a decision for that urban reserve? What kind of soil and land are you looking for? What's the criteria?
Mr. Chair, the criteria are the same as you would use for putting an urban growth land in the urban growth boundary. That is to say, the main criteria is need. You have to show that you would need this land at some point within the next 50 years. A. B, then there's a hierarchy. You would look to exceptions lands first, then you would look to the poorer farmland, and finally, and lastly, the
poorer farmland to begin with. Oh, interesting. You've led us to believe that we're going to be placing these out in high-value farmland. And now we find out the hierarchy leads us to the worst first.
Mr. What we know from the Metro Urban Growth Boundary experience is high-value farmland is in the urban reserve. The hierarchy doesn't mean you don't end up with any high-value farmland, because in the valley cities, yes, the hierarchy is there. The problem with the hierarchy is when you start looking for a 50-year supply of land around a Willamette Valley city, you're not going to be able to find it on just exceptions and poor value farmland. So once you go out 50 years, I anticipate most of the Willamette Valley cities would have a great deal of high value farmland.
But we're trying to find that lower value land first, right?
Absolutely.
Just one more comment, Mr. Chair. All of this speaks to me to the illogic of having urban growth boundaries, period. But it seems to me that the conflict here is between desired growth by a community and the plan approved by DFCD, not conflicts within the city and the school district.
Mr. Chair?
Okay, Morgan.
Just a comment, too, that from the testimony that we've seen, this appears to be responding to a problem in the metro area of the state. This isn't something that maybe Medford has to deal with a little bit, but the rest of us really don't have to deal with this. And that this appears to me to be a valid tool for the school district and the urban service providers to enter into a reasonable dialogue and come up with a reasonable solution to help put schools on the ground that make the best use of a scarce resource, which is education dollars. And that this is a valuable tool to give people to use.
I'm familiar with the Washington County area because I drive through it to my district. And I also understand that those are some of the fastest growing school districts in our state there in Hillsboro. And if I was Superintendent Yvonne Katz, I would also be looking for some cheaper land to build a school on, which they much need. But in doing so, we're going to roll right over the county planning process, as I understand it. They have designated these boundaries. The uses are out there, not immediate. They're not in the urban growth boundary. They're out in the reserve area. It's where the schools are being sought. If I were a school superintendent and I could go out in the country and on flat land, farmland, build a school at a lesser price, I guess that's what I would do, and that's what I've seen done in the state I moved from, in Idaho. And I think that Mr. Wendy's observations are correct. The next thing you see are other services springing up around those. And I have sympathy for the Beaverton District, but I'm unwilling to go here, even though this is my good colleague's well-thought-out solution to the Beaverton problem.
Mr. Chair. Muckley.
If we place a school out in the middle of farmland, and have we had any experience with conflicts with farming around that school? And I'm basically, my main concern is pesticide application.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I don't know about those. I think the Farm Bureau is here, and they could probably better speak to that. We have heard the testimony on the previous bill that there are conflicts between farming and schools, and that those, and I haven't heard those sort of set out individually as to what they all are. I would be surprised if the pesticide application wasn't one of those conflicts.
Follow on, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We have, and I don't know Beaverton's condition in detail, but I gather there aren't some significant chunks of land left within the urban growth boundary in which a school can really be sited, at least not without prohibitive costs because you're competing against Intel or so on and so forth for large chunks of land. Is that a problem in your knowledge, and what are the other alternatives for solving it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, as I testified a couple weeks ago, we think, you know, we recognize it's a hard problem, and that the land outside the boundary is much cheaper. And, of course, that's why so many other types of uses have been added to the EFU list. Every session, people are in asking, you know, looking for another thing to be cited in EFU zones. It's now about 49 uses. But the what we have proposed and what we have placed in the statute to solve this problem is a requirement that when cities compute the 20-year land supply, that they include in that a 20-year land supply for schools. We think that the urban growth boundary estimation, if you will, of a land supply ought to include not just a land supply for housing and employment, but ought to include, the cities ought to be required, and the statute now says that, but they ought to be required to think about where schools will be and make sure the supply includes that. That's a fairly new statute, so it's going to be a while as the cities come into periodic review and they adjust to that. But I think that Metro, in their latest round, would have had to comply with that and latest did recently amend their urban growth boundaries, presumably in part to provide some additional land for a school.
Do counties essentially use exclusive use zoning to set aside land for school in that process, or what guarantees that a school will be able to compete against other development opportunities to obtain a parcel large enough for a school?
Chair, I don't think that there's any public, you know, counties or cities, I might be wrong, but in general they don't try and earmark a specific site and zone it just for a school prior to a school district actually having bought that property. It's usually not done. So what that usually means, I think school districts are competing on the private markets for school district lands. You're correct in that. Which is why I think there is a temptation to go to EFU land. That's in part why this whole concern arises, is that school districts are looking for land outside the boundary because it's cheaper. And the only reason that we've imposed any limits in a land use planning program is that in the long run, then we do see schools going out beyond the urban growth, and there would be the temptation, if it wasn't for our limits, for schools to be generally outside urban growth boundaries on farmland. I think that's how it would work if we didn't have any limitations.
Okay, I'm going to cut it off here. We're going to have some more amendments, I think, so I'll bring this up later. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate it. We hammered this thing on quite a bit. So I'm going to close a work session on 3259, and we'll open a work session on 3489. That's me, Lundquist.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, and you know.
Yes, on House Bill 3259, is that being held over?
Yes, and Lundquist, welcome. Thank you very much, Chairman. Lynn Lundquist, State Representative from House District 59. I want you to ask you to shift gears now a little bit. You've been talking about prime farmland, and now we're going to talk about a non-farm parcel. Take 20 seconds to respond to Representative Merkley's question in the last session, last part of the hearing, in regard to the conflict between schools out in rural Oregon and the farming community. I can cite you an example where there was definitely a conflict. I lived right across from the schools all my grade school life, and every time I ran outside without my coat on, my mother saw that. And so that's the conflict, I think, that is apropos. The rest I'm not sure are there. Mr. Chairman, this House Bill 3489, as I spoke to you before in a general sense about the Garvin case, what this simply does is clarifies in the statute how non-farm parcels were divided for purposes of non-farm dwellings prior to the County Board of Appeals decision on Cook County. I want to make sure that everybody understands the next question or statement I'm going to make. When the Garvin case came forward, the department, Thousand Friends of Oregon, everyone connected with the land use process,
was extremely surprised, because no one had been operating under that, under the new court case, under those kinds of stipulations, and so it caught everybody by surprise. And as I asked my friends from the Thousand Friends of Oregon, as we tried to work through this bill, you know, can we get together and come to consensus over this? And their position was, well, they were given a gift and they'd like to stay with it. And I can understand that position, but I think we want to point out the fact that's what happened. And so we're simply trying to return this to clarify the statute so that we can go back to the pre-Dorfman situation. The Dorfman case did, it simply said, when you divided a non-farm parcel, the remaining portion of the parcel, all of this is non-farm now, the remaining portion has to meet the minimum size, which is 80 acres in the particular area we're dealing with. The practice, however, and as I said before, I served on Cook County Planning Commission for a good number of years, and we would divide these non-farm parcels, take a 40 and divide it through 20s, or take a 80 and divide it in maybe 330s, whatever the case happened to be. That, but we did not have any situation where the remaining parcel needed to be meet the minimum size. I hope that you have before you some maps or some drawings that I will try to walk through you with them, because I think this explains it as well as we possibly can. And it is a complicated issue. It's not one that that you understand, anyone understands very readily. So we have on the first one called Situation A. This is a Dorfman situation. And I just happen to have a 100-acre parcel here that is split out, the remaining being greater than 80 acres, so it's okay. And that 15 acres could be a 5 acres, it could be whatever the parcel that you want to split off that would meet the other requirements. But the remaining had to be at least 80 acres plus. If we go to situation, into situation B, small I, this is a situation where you have the original parcel being less than the minimum. It's 60 acres, it's not 80. And so you could cut it into 320s if you so chose. Every parcel must be at least 20 acres in size, and the remainder must be 20 acres, so it meets all those standards. Then if you go to B, 2 little I, you have the situation where, again, it's below the 80-acre minimum. In this case, we have 30 acres as an example. You can split the 20 acres off if, and this is a big if the 10 acres remaining is consolidated with another parcel that meets the 80-acre size. We probably should have had another 70 acres drawn on the side over there. So that would mean like a lot line adjustment. If you could, you know, sell the 10 acres to a neighbor that became part of that parcel, so you're not creating a 10-acre parcel. Okay. And then if we go to the C3 amendments, and this is where we're really driving to. In this example, we have a 90-acre parcel, and what it says is you could divide that parcel as long as none of the divisions was less than 20 acres. So you see where you could have, in this example, you could have two 20-acre parcels and two 25s or three 20s and a 30, whatever case happens to be. That is the crux of the Dorfman case right there, is that you could divide that into that combination. Now, all of those I've talked about so far are the dash 3 amendments. The only difference between the dash 3 and the dash 4 is that under the dash 4, which is amendments that were drawn working with the department, DLCD department, they asked that we also present this particular story. And that's where if you had something like in this case, a 90-acre parcel, you could only divide three parcels, two divisions, ending up with three parcels, and that's it. So it's more restrictive than the dash three amendments. Now, that's a presentation of trying to go back to where we believe we were functioning prior to, and did function for years, prior to the Dorfman case. Now, there are a couple issues here that have come into our amendments that we need to chat a little bit about. President Morgan has been good enough to go over this and bring a couple issues. One of them is that this may deal with non-farm uses and exclusive just to dwellings, and we will need to bring that issue forward on the Senate side. You have my word that we will work with the Senate under the time frame that we have. We want to bring all the people to the table, and including the work group prior to actually going to the Senate hearings. There's that issue, and also there's an issue in regard to the soil types in the bill. It's in the amendments. It talks about a 90%. I know there's some people that question whether that's the right determination of the percentage, and so we would want to work with that as well. We've worked with the department. We've worked with the governor's office. The department, I'm sure, will come up, I believe, and testify on this. They may not be pleased with all of this, but let me emphasize this. If your goal is simply to not have any more foxes in rural Oregon, obviously you're not going to like this. But if your goal of mine is to have a reasonable planning process that allows some division, and 20 acres, let me emphasize to you, is a pretty, and I see some of you obviously with a varying background know what I'm talking about here, 20 acres is a pretty large-sized parcel. It's not where you're creating neighbors right next to neighbors. With all the complications it has. Again, this is non-farm parcels that we're talking about. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I know you're under a tight time constraint. I'll answer any questions.
Representative Morris.
Representative Lundquist, would you consider a conceptual amendment to take subsection 3 out of section 1 here?
Mr. Chairman, Reverend Morgan, that is putting into law, as I understand it, what is already there, but with more clarity. I'm hoping anything will make this work in a constructive manner. Maybe you can tell me the reason there.
My concern there is the non-farm use is part of this thing and its applicability to the Durbanen decision. And just trying to forestall that whole discussion.
How my staff has been working on this a lot. If you have. Okay. In conferring with my staff, says that would not alter what we want to do as far as the non-farm. Parcel or like a home site, so that would be okay.
Mr. Chair, I think any more than we used to. Representative Lundquist, I still don't understand situation C. I'm sorry, but I followed you until we got to that. And you said this is the crux of the Durbanen case, so I think I better try to understand it better. These are non-farm parcels. This was 90 acres before division. This is how the -3 amendments would allow it to be divided. And that differs considerably from the other two cases that we were, or three cases that we were shown. In that it's more divisions, and you believe that this amendment would take us back to what the law was before the ruling in the Durbanen case?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, the size of the parcels is actually no different in the three than it is in, for example, B or B, one small I or single I or double I. The difference is in situation A to C. And that's the difference between the Durbanen case. And again, Representative Taylor, the smallest parcel under C is 20. Now, you could be, you know, that I've been saying that could be a 30 and another 20 or some combination. Now, that's the maximum that it could be divided into. It doesn't have to obviously be divided into that, but that would be the maximum. Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, the part for me that's so hard to understand is that if you have a parcel that's 40 acres and then divided into two parcels of 20, and that's okay, it doesn't make any sense to me that with an 80, you have a, let's say 100 and divide 120 off and the rest has to remain 80. I don't see the consistency in that thought process.
I certainly can't see that. I just am trying to understand. These are non-farm dwellings, so these are not farm properties. They have no income. They don't meet the income requirements. They have no. They're not zoned exclusive farm use, or are they?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, they could be a zoned farm use. Simply, as I pointed out time before last year, when all the land, like in Cook County, was zoned farm use, unless you were in the urban growth boundary in the 1970s when we did that. But this land has to meet the other test. You know, if it's farmland, it will not be able to be divided like this. We're talking about truly non-productive farmland. But the only thing you have going on the property, so to speak, would be the house and maybe some ground grass or something. It is not a farm parcel.
This is true.
That's the name of on Merkle.
On page 1 of 3049, I'm trying to check to make sure this isn't being removed by your amendment, but in the section starting on line 16, where it says, may approve a proposed division of land, so on and so forth, in an exclusive farm use zone for non-farm uses. Maybe I'm missing the point here, but it looks to me like we start out with a large piece of land in an exclusive farm use purpose, and we end up with a bunch of 20-acre homesteads in non-farm use, and how is that consistent with keeping farm, I mean, isn't the worst of all cases, not only are we dismantling the farmland, but we're dismantling it into 20-acre estates for non-farm purposes.
Mr. Chairman, Reverend Merkley, first of all, I think you're looking at the bill. This is a gut and stuff.
That's what I was wondering.
Okay. So it's the dash 3. Again, let me emphasize that these parcels have to meet non-farm parcel criteria. That's the crux of the issue. We're not talking about farmland. I'm staying completely away from that.
I'll have to go back to the drawing board here.
And again, I want to emphasize that I want to continue to work with all parties, because I think there are some things we need to look at in here a little bit. Nothing that, in my opinion, directly affects the size of the parcel. That's not the issue with some of the other, as you're indicating, some of the farm or the non-farm uses. That issue, I think, needs to be clarified. Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, this, my preference would be to make sure we do that right. And I'm a little bit nervous about just picking out a section. It might be the right way to do it. But I'm not in any way saying I don't want to do this. Accomplish what you and I talked about privately.
Mr. Chair, can I make a comment? The Representative Lundquist, can you kind of explain to me why we couldn't try to work with this in the context of this committee, why it's a better alternative to move it over to the Senate and work it over there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, if there's time available, I'm wide open to that. That's fine. I don't know what kind of time constraint Mr. Chair is under in this issue. So that's a decision I'd like to have a committee.
Mr. Chair. I'm now on the correct dash 3, I believe. Is the dash 3 the...
Yes.
Okay. Line 20. The section starting on line 18 of the first page, dash 3,
notes that governing body ... in an exclusive farm use zone. And it, again, I come back to my basic question, which is that it appears to me that we're starting with an exclusive farm use zone and we're dividing it up into very large, by very large, I mean large non-farm use purposes, 20-acre estates. What am I missing?
Mr. Chair, Reverend Murphy, if you'd just beyond where you start reading there for farm use zone for non-farm uses. And the issue is, I mean, if it doesn't qualify as a non-farm parcel, it doesn't qualify at all. It has to have a non-farm parcel use. So that's, if you had a section of land or 5 or 10 sections of land, and, you know, they're all they're designated farm use, and they truly are farm parcels, farmable parcels, I guess I'd put it on, then they won't qualify for that. All of you on the committee could take me to places where that would be applicable.
I understand your clarification. I thought the non-farm uses was clarifying the purpose of the parcels that were being created rather than the status of the exclusive farm use zone. And I guess I just raise a question to make sure that the language is non-farm land rather than farmland.
And I think as I understand this, this is clarified if you read this in the context of the whole back tree. It is truly non-farm parcels. The question that Representative Morgan has regarding non-farm uses that might be a little bit of a problem here that I think we need to clarify. And I accept that we should do that. But in relationship to yours, Representative Murphy, I'm very comfortable that we are only talking about non-farm parcels in this case.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Is this facsimile that we got from the Deschutes County Legal Council still operative? Does it still address that part of the bill that still exists? In it, Bruce White says that the department, meaning DLCD, has no coherent policy for regulating the creation of new non-farm parcels. And he suggests that this is because outside of Dorvin and Chase, there's no such law to apply. I would really like to have the department speak to that. I know that a lot of people have done a lot of work on this. I see in his letter former Representative Luke, now Commissioner Luke, mentioned, and I know that Ray Baum worked on it in the 1993 session, and so we're having a hard time catching up here with everything that's gone before us. So,
I will be more than happy to bring the department forward here, and I think it's Bruce White and Howard Payne here. I know they wanted to give testimony real quick, too, so we can let them talk, and we'll bring the department, and I'll make a decision what we got to do here.
Okay.
I think we're going to have a little more work, and I did receive from a county in my district, too, some concerns. So I think we're going to have to clean some of that up. We do have Dorvin and Chase down in Douglas County, but we worked on, and I was preparing legislation along with Representative Morgan for this session, too, and but we haven't resolved their concerns for this, and I want them to take a look at this also and get it cleaned up before we... I'd like to get as close as possible before we send it to the Senate. It would be my preference.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with you 100%. I just don't... You're the one to decide the time frame.
Mr. Chairman.
Griffin Gino.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lentz, I just have one quick question, and I apologize. I was out of the room in case you covered, but it's on your... the second sheet of your diagram, and it's the 30-acre square, the 10 acres that's consolidated.
Yes.
I read the illustration. I didn't understand that one part consolidated.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Yanella, there is a situation where if you say you had 30 acres, the minimum has to be 20. So you could not divide that because you would have the remaining being only 10. There is a provision that if the 10 that's remaining is consolidated with the neighbor's parcel that is more than 80 acres with the 10, then it would be allowable. I really should have had a 70-acre piece drawn off the side there, probably, so that the remaining, the 10 acres would not just remain by itself. It has to come part of another parcel that meets the minimum lot size of 80 acres.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Does the neighbor have to have ownership of this 10 acres?
Yes. Yes. It would have to change ownership. That's what they call a lot line adjustment.
Okay.
Where they can do that. But absolutely, the ownership has to change.
Okay.
We would not create anything less than 20 acres and still the remaining being 80.
Thank you, Ms. Representative Lundquist. Appreciate it.
May I just make one more point before the representative leaves? So my understanding is that the only situation under which you would be able to create a parcel that was less than 20 acres for a non-farm dwelling would be if the size of the original parcel is ends up being either 80 acres on the west side or 160 acres on the east side.
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, this is more than that. Just like that's where we are right now.
That's what the dash threes would propose.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
For the A, it's the A example.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I'm about to bring up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll bring up doing a bit of travel, but a distance here. So I'll give them a moment at the testimony. Bruce White and Howard Payne.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
Your direction
of
where you want to
go. Yeah, I think we'll just hold over and work on that thing, okay?
No.
Are you going to go in 23 or 21? Yeah. Okay, again, I'll talk to you on the way.
Yeah. This is
I'm keeping that note in front of me. Until we're done. This is pretty done. This is done. On
28th.
Okay, don't let
me go.
Okay, that's fine. But, you know, if you're going to talk, I'll talk on the same thing. I don't have that kind of time.
Yeah.
So choose who you want to speak and let's get on with it.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. We're not the same. My name is George Wade. I'm the Chief County Community Development Director, and we are not the same party. These gentlemen have an entirely different issue.
Okay. All right. And then let's have a spokesman from one of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Howard Payne. I'm from Central Oregon. And what I'm really concerned about in this bill is that it does nothing to reduce the proliferation of non-farm dwellings. And needless to say, we have many of them in Central Oregon. And this is essentially going to promote a more conversion of farmland to non-farm uses. And currently in the state, every 20 new houses built is on land zoned for farm use is statewide. One of every 20 new houses built statewide is on land zoned for farm use.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I ask you to cite the source of that information?
This information was published in the Oregonian in December. They did a 5 or 6 part series on growth in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
And this, they quoted DLCD from this information. From 1986 to 1997, Oregon counties approved 10,100 houses and other structures in exclusive farm use zones, and 4,014 of those houses were unrelated to commercial farming. And to give an example of what's happening with non-farm dwellings, in 1997, there were 95 primary farm dwellings approved and 604 non-farm dwellings. And so we're really concerned about that. And I recently read in the Oregonian that the Farm Bureau now estimates 17,000 of Oregon's 37,500 farms are hobby-type farms sitting on less than 50 acres. And under this House Bill 3489, those number of hobby farms will actually increase and the acreage will probably get smaller. And that's all I have. This gentleman's from the Land Use Organization in Deschutes County. Maybe he has some comments.
Well, if you'd like me to go on, I'll just mention briefly, I'm chairman of the organization that has challenged the county on this particular problem, and that's probably why we are here at the present time. I think the county would prefer, rather than to carry out the LUBRA process, to have some kind of circumvention of the legal process and make use of the legislature for circumvention. I have a brief statement if you want to hear it.
Have you got it written? You can give it to us.
Yes, I have passed it out. I think you have some of it there.
It goes on the record then. So I don't need it read to me.
Okay, fine. So you be sure to read it carefully, because currently there are things happening right now in relation to this process that have not been talked about, and I think that's the main reason why this bill has been brought up, is to take the county out of the position that they're in of having to carry it on to LUBRA, which we think they really ought to be doing, because we believe there's been a serious violation of the law.
Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate that. President Gino.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chairman. I didn't get your name there.
My name's Mr. Chairman, Gianella. My name's Howard Payne.
Mr. Payne, what county were all these homes built in?
On the one side, the information I quoted, this was statewide.
Statewide. Are there counties within that?
I don't have that information. Mm-hmm. That was, as I stated, information published in Oregonian, quoted from PLC.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yes, President Merkley.
I raised the question to the sponsor of the bill as to whether this was enabling us to carve up farmland into fairly sizable non-farm use parcels, and he argued, I thought, that the only land that he's intending to affect is non-farmland land. I don't read the statute that way, but your testimony seems to suggest that indeed this would enable farmland to be carved into non-farm purposes. Is that indeed your intention?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that's correct. This is exclusive farm use zoned land.
Now, it may not be prime land, but it's being used for farming.
Mr. Chair, could I make a comment?
Yes, everything
right. For purposes of clarification, for Representative Merkley, once you get outside of the urban growth boundaries of cities, the land that is outside of there is only generally able to be zoned two ways, and it's either forest land or agriculture land. And agriculture land is divided down into crop land and grazing land. And so we have a situation here where the kind of agricultural crop land that is in this area here is zoned ag land. And down in the district where I live in Douglas County, we have steep-sided narrow valleys that are covered with scrub oak and madrone, and that's also zoned ag land. And the level of protection on those two types of land is exactly the same. Of course, the level of use is very different, and the ability of people to make an income off of the land is also very different. And so what this is about is an attempt to deal with the land that's zoned for agricultural uses but isn't what you would consider to be the same kind of ag land as ag land in the Willamette Valley by any means.
Well, I'm misrepresenting Morgan, and you can try to meet with me after the hearing to clarify for me, probably a longer conversation. I don't see in the statute the distinguishing between different types of farmland. It looks to me like it's saying all exclusive
Well, and that, Mr. Merkley, is one of the very basic problems that I'm just finding often in this state, is that there is no way to differentiate under the system.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. And we've got Deschutes County here with us, too, and let them give testimony. We can move on.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bruce White. I'm Deputy County Counsel. Here's just one of my memos in your packet, and I've also just distributed some testimony. We're here because we have been challenged in our approving non-farm dwellings in the Shorbanen case. As Representative Lundquist stated, we were surprised, as was everybody else, at the holding of the Dorbin case, and we think it was wrongly decided. We do have a case now at LUBA on this issue, and we'll be trying to overturn the LUBA's and the Court of Appeals decision, but obviously that's an uphill battle when you're fighting to overturn two previous court cases right on point, so that's why we have joined in this effort for legislative fix, and we think that we need a fix. An 80-acre minimum lot size across the board just doesn't work, and furthermore, it's contrary to statute. Non-farm uses other than non-farm dwellings, the statute says that the parcels you carve off are to be as small as possible. You can't possibly square that with an 88-acre lot size. So we do need a fix here. I think the issue is going to be what the contour of the fix is. We generally support what we saw as being the Dash 1 amendment. Did not see the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments until today. We're concerned we need something that will pass and get signed by the governor. It does us no good if we try to go for the whole loaf and can't get a signature. So I think the thing that concerns us, we've never done series partitions, at least in 5 or 6 years. I understand that that's for the Dash 3 amendments, and since that makes the bill less palatable, that's a concern to us. We don't care what other counties choose to do with partition, but we just know that might be an issue in terms of being ultimate pass, ultimate signature. And I'll just ask George Reed if you have any quick comments.
Sure. Well, members of the committee, thank you. I'd like to make a couple of comments following up on what Representative Lundquist said. Yes, we agree with what he said, but there's a couple of things, and this shows the difference in counties and how we do business. But an issue is, can you develop farm, divide farmland? And the issue that was said is, no, this, we're talking about land that's not farmland, but occasionally you want to break off a parcel that is generally unsuitable for a farm use from a farm. And right now, under the Dorvin, what was held in Dorvin, and that parcel has to be 80 acres. In our county, we've allowed isolated unproductive pieces to be broken off and to be small. As a matter of fact, we encourage them to be very small. So that's a concern that wasn't brought up. I wanted to point that out. Also, in the all of the Dash 3 and 4 amendments, I think Representative Morgan brought up a concern that we have. It's a very valid concern. There's a lot of the uses, let's say fire stations, for example. This would say that the remainder parcel, you can break off a 1-acre fire station parcel only if you had an 80-acre parcel to break it off from. I think that's wrong, so I think that's something that we need to work on. This is very complicated. We were here at the last session before this committee, and we dealt with series partitions. I believe Mr. Lundquist may have erred in saying that Dorvin said you can't do series partitions. We debated that issue last legislative session, and I did a survey of county planning directors, including Tripp County, who I found out later didn't have a planning director at that time, so didn't respond. They did do series partitions, but we found no other counties who did series partitions. That's the difference between the Draft 3 and Draft 4 bill. So again, as Bruce said, we're concerned that we, if we go beyond Dorvin and just fixing the Dorvin case, that we might jeopardize this bill. So that's where we would differ from what Representative Lundquist presented to. I guess we're open to questions. I would say that Bruce probably has done more research on this
issue than anybody I know in preparing this case. We submitted some testimony that's very extensive, has a lot of background. We don't care which forum we get to fix this better, but we would welcome the opportunity to stay on with anybody and try to come up with a consensus.
Well, I see that our drafts are not close enough yet, and that's why I want to get, you know, right on the building and not beyond. And I think that we can get there, but it may take a couple of another draft to do that. I'd like to bring, we've got to keep moving here. I'd like to bring that the department speak on this if they'd like. Ron, did you want to? Okay. Thank you very much. All right, did you want to call? Okay, come on, Apple.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Spock, I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I just wanted to state on the record our interest in absorbing and fix. I was part of the work groups that were involved in the 93 session with the development of House Bill 3661, and at that time it was intended to have a fix of what was called the Smith case to allow a part of parcel in eastern Oregon and these non-farm parcels to be divided. That was clearly the intent of the 93 legislation. The Gorbanen case takes part of that away, and the association is interested in a fix to that, and I would just want to express my interest in working with the work group to solve the problem and bring a product to you.
I think we should probably, I appreciate you recommending a work group, but I think we should. So we can move into this and get that fixed and get approval. I think Douglas County would probably want to.
Definitely.
Yeah, and so we get right on what we need here. Appreciate that. Okay, Ron?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And without getting into all the details, we will concur that a working group would be productive. This is one of the most complex and controversial aspects of exclusive farm use zoning. I have been working on this issue off and on since at least the 1977 session, and it is difficult. I would point out on the last page of our testimony, I have a brief summary of some of the background history on non-farm dwellings, as well as a brief summary of what we see the Dorbanen opinions, what they do and don't do, and what might need clarification. I would also point out that we think that the current DASH 3 and 4 amendments go beyond what the Dorbanen case affected and clearly do not take effect to what the law was before the amendment. They would create additional opportunities for new parcels for non-farm dwellings that were not available before the Dorbanen decision. I think that Representative Lundquist and the diagrams prepared by his aide, Jessica Harris, are very good. I think in summary I could point out that their situation A is what we believe the law was after 3661. The issue that was affected in Dorbanen was whether or not you could divide a parcel that was less than the minimum. That really wasn't discussed at the time under 3661. I was also part of the working groups at the time. And that was the aspect of that case that surprised people. I think the issue is, I don't think you can get concurrence about what the law was on that point prior to that case. Now, Luba and the Court of Appeals have said what the law is or what the effect of that legislation was. I think the issue before all of us is what is the best policy when dealing with non-conforming parcels and whether we should divide them further. With regard to the situation C, whether in the DASH 3 or DASH 4 amendments, it's our view that the ability to divide a parcel larger than the minimum where all the remaining parcels are less than the minimum was not allowed under 3661, was not the law, and that going back to that
is something new and is something we can't support. The other point that concerns us is in the Dash 3 amendments, the restrictions that were put in place last session in 1997 that restricted, actually clarified that subdivisions were not allowed for non-farm dwelling purposes, and further said that series partitions were not allowed. That would be removed by the Dash 3 amendments, and we clearly don't want to go back and remove that. That is something that was not affected by the Dorvenin case and shouldn't be something that we're looking at, because that would simply allow increased opportunities for more non-farm dwellings. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll stop. We're willing to work with the group and would welcome that opportunity. I think something is possible, but the current amendments are, we don't feel, are appropriate or consistent with that case.
Okay, let's put together a work group here and I'll reschedule. But is there a committee member who would like to work? Perhaps St. Morgan would like to work on this work group. Please, anyone else here would like to be on the work group? Okay, we will learn.
One work group, I think I had time, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to do it.
Okay, and we'll have the department and currently the county farm bureau probably thousand friends, yes. So we'll get your chance there and I'll give you a chance when we finally get the product done, then we get maybe give you approval. Yeah. What's that? All right. And it's 1,000 friends directly on the work group, I'm sure. So let's get to work on as quick as possible here and come up with a product. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate it. All right. Let's close the work session on 3489. All right, let's see who else. Who's been waiting? Let's open a work session on House Bill 3282.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing Speaker Snodgrass here with House Bill 3282. And you'll recall when we were dealing with church siding, and you'll recall when we brought this up the first time, you heard testimony from Speaker Snodgrass that her church was getting too large. It was at the point where they were needing about 8 or 9 services, and they decided to relocate to a piece of land that would accommodate the church and their facilities and what they need to operate. And that church moved less than a mile from its present location, but under current rule, it was within 3 miles of an urban growth boundary. And she showed you that between Gresham's urban growth boundary and Sandy's urban growth boundary, they overlapped. There was no chance to be 3 miles away from them or more. Representative Crummel also testified in his instance where his church actually burned to the ground, and because the remnants of the church were broken down and cleared away, his church could actually not rebuild on its present location because it was on high-value farmland. So we sought to remedy these instances, and because this decision would affect several other church cases that were known by at least the folks who worked on Lynn's church site, an issue for Good Shepherd Community Church. So we attempted to remedy the situation, and we introduced the Dash 1 amendment a few weeks ago, and they said that a church could locate without regard to where it was in relation to the urban growth boundary and without regard to the soil classification. Now, we understand that there are some ramifications of that that members of the committee would be uncomfortable with, and we wanted to work with the Farm Bureau to draft something that would be more comfortable to them. So I give to you today the dash 2 amendment of House Bill 3282. And I got these, I hope you have them. I made enough copies for the committee, but I got these 15 minutes before the start of the committee. And these dash 2 amendments are a product of myself and Mr. Schellenberg. And I want to be clear about the Farm Bureau. These amendments allow them to be in a position of neutrality on the bill. So what the amendments say, as we ratchet it down just a bit, in instances where churches are cited, where the urban growth boundaries, where 3 miles from the urban growth boundaries may overlap, in other words, there's less than 6 miles between urban growth boundaries, that we will let a church site there without regard to soil classification. And for instances in which the urban growth boundaries do not overlap, we'll ratchet it down and say that a church may site without regard to soil classification out to 2 miles from an urban growth boundary. So we actually ratchet it down in that case. The rest of the amendments merely say that if it is more than 2 miles from an urban growth boundary, then it has to be on a parcel that is 5 acres or less, and that is on is on soil that's not composed of high-value soil. So this is our attempt to modify the bill, to ratchet it down and make it more specific and hopefully more acceptable to the members of the committee.
Could be in urban reserve areas that really identified as being less than high-value farmland, right?
Sure.
Okay, that's good.
So I present to you the dash 2 amendments.
Yeah, I appreciate
that.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
I have a party.
Yeah, I'm in work session. Yeah. Anyone else want to speak on this? Yes, thank you.
Chael, does this then accommodate the Boring Church on a 31 acres that they had chosen, as I recall?
Absolutely, because what this does, because that church did not have an opportunity to be outside of the 3 mile barrier, because the distance between the urban growth boundaries between Sandy and Gresham was less than 6 miles, it could not follow that rule by virtue of its location between the two. Yes, it would accommodate this church.
The other thing, if I might continue, Mr. Chair, that I recall that the minister said he didn't really particularly care about the cemetery part of it.
That's true, but I think that's the common phrase that is in statute.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
And I don't,
so we have no objection if that's taken out, obviously, but I think that's how it is.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, at the last hearing, we heard the concerns of the agency about the exceptions process and other options that they thought including expanding urban growth boundaries. And they made the observation that we couldn't protect the farm community if we do this. I wonder if we might hear from them again, if they think the dash 2 amendments might be any more acceptable.
From that agency?
This was Mr. Eber again. John?
I don't see him here. We got Bob Lindy. I don't know if he wants to speak on it. I don't know if they're worried.
Be any better.
I'm ready to move it.
Mr. Chair, I move dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3282.
President Cruz moves dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3282. Any further discussion? Hearing none, any opposition?
No.
Oh, no. Taylor, you know.
Oh, no, I'm fine. I'm moving in.
Okay.
Okay. All right, hearing them. So moved.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I move House Bill 3282 as amended to the floor with the House recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 3282 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative Daniello? Aye. Representative Kapoor? No. Representative Merkel? Excuse. Representative Morgan? Aye. Representative Taylor? No. Representative Sherwell? Aye. Having the required number of votes, House Bill 3282 has been amended. Floor of the due pass recommendation. And our work session is closed on 3282. And let's open a work session on. Let's go to another subject here and get off the land use for a minute, give ourselves a quick mind refreshing.
I think Paul loves land use.
Yeah, I know that. I was afraid he was going to fall out of his chair asleep. So let's open the House Bill.
You need a chair.
Yeah, carrier. Who would like to carry 3282? Not that?
Yeah.
That's her bill. Let's see if she'd like to anyway. Representative and Speaker Snodgrass for House Bill 3282. And if not, she will appoint another one of us.
I bet you could.
We'll open a work session on House Bill 3201. Hold on. Patrick's coming down, you know?
He was not at this point.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Castro representing Christ Creek Landfill. I was told by a judge once that you should never, ever say, I'm only going to be here a minute, but I really am going to commit to you. I think we can do this in a couple of minutes. Dry Creek Landfill is a landfill in Jackson County. Representative Patrick was kind enough to introduce this bill at our session to have. This deals with eliminating duplication and easing some mandates on local governments with respect to advisory committees dealing with solid waste. In just a moment of history, in 1987, I believe it was, this legislature passed a series of statutes, 459, 315 through 330. At the time, Metro was looking for a new landfill to replace the old State Jones landfill. And the purpose of statutes were to have a county appoint an advisory committee, the county that was going to receive the new regional landfill, to appoint an advisory committee to discuss issues that might be brought up by siting the landfill. Since that time, a lot of counties and other local governments now have general advisory committees for solid waste. And what this bill does, as amended by the Dash 3 amendment, is that it eliminates the duplication that now would be required if the county had a regional landfill and its own general solid waste committee. It would have to have two. What the bill, as amended by the Dash 3, does means they can only have one that combines all of the activities of both. So we've worked these out with the Department of Environmental Quality, and Bob Denkel's here.
Bob's here.
And I think Kristen Mitchell from Oregon Refuge and Recycling is in.
If Bob doesn't want to be testing our eyes, give me a thumbs up and we'll go.
And I would be happy to answer.
It'll be Friday afternoon.
I'd be happy to answer any questions this year.
Okay, questions from the committee.
Can we look down?
Yes.
Chair?
Let's see. Support.
I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3201.
Move Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3201. Any further discussion? Hearing none. So move. No. Any opposition? Excuse me. No opposition. So move.
Mr. Chair.
Support.
I move House Bill 3201 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kapoor. I move House Bill 3201 with the Dash 3 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Gianello? Aye. Representative Kapoor? Aye. Representative Hartley? Aye. Representative Morgan? Aye. 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 to close the hearing on House Bill 32, close the fourth session on House Bill 3201. Okay, I do too. Let's move to open a work session in HJR 75. What do you want to call Bob real quick? I'm just going to
Sure. Chair?
Anything Cruz?
I move HJR 75 to call for DFAS recommendation.
Yes, thank you. I move HJR 75 to call for DFAS recommendation. Do you have any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, first thing. Yes,
excuse me.
Oh,
I amend my motion to refer HJR 75 to the Committee on Ways and Means for the DFAS recommendation.
Yes, thank you. Advises to motion to state HJR 75 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I am not in favor of the bill, and I will therefore be voting no on this motion.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin. Mr. Chairman, I'm also not in favor of the bill and will not be voting for it. And before we get into a long philosophical discussion, I'll just state on the record that I think local jurisdictions have the right to do local land use planning already.
You really are cutting off a lot of discussion.
I won't say anything, I just don't know.
Okay, hearing no further. Right. Could the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye. No.
Aye.
Nope.
No.
Aye.
No.
Aye. Having required number votes, HAR 75 passes to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Okay. Close the work session on HJR 75. We open a work session on the House Bill 3410 and our last bill for Friday, April 30th, last day of the month.
End of the year.
How about this?
What a dubious.
And I promise.
Take that, son. We're going to go.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Chandler, Oregon Building Industry Association, on 3410-3 amendments thereto. We heard this bill three weeks ago. If you want me to, I'd be glad to go through a quick synopsis of what the bill does. It's simply trying to clarify a bill that passed in 1995 with regard to clear and objective approval standards. The DASH-3 amendments were worked out by Mr. Honeycutt, myself, and the Department of Land Conservation and Development. They had some quibbles with the language. We have addressed those quibbles, and the DASH-3 amendments meet with their approval.
Good. And what's the deal on the fiscal? Have you guys seen anything on
that? No one tells me nothing, Mr. Chairman.
You to know, basically.
Exactly right.
What do we have on that?
Mr. Chair, members, we don't have anything worked up yet, but the number of fiscal fittings from different positions is put over the $50,000 mark.
I got a call.
Mr. Chair, can I ask witnesses, in your opinion, does that sound reasonable?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, absolutely not.
It is, yes.
Mr. Chair, I would submit that oftentimes when we are trying to do something that an agency doesn't like, they throw a fiscal on it to try to deflect it.
Let Bob,
Chair,
Ron, come up and defend himself, if he would, real quick on a fiscal.
Chair Welch, Representative Cruz, I think Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Interaction. I don't think the agencies, there isn't any agencies that don't like this bill.
I don't see it. Bob, there's Bob. We have the question of fiscal. I guess my committee administrator got a telephone call on the fiscal on this, and we're trying to figure that one out. Why?
I'm not sure why there would be a fiscal, but there has been
Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I don't know if I concur, but there's some concern that these standards then become even more difficult, and therefore local governments will have to make additional amendments to their approval standards. And that would mean there might be about Measure 30 impact. My own opinion is that what the bill now says is what we have thought all along, that Clean Objective Standards meant. But I'm not speaking for the cities, and you might ask them, and that may be where it's coming from.
Well, we get a clear and objective definition. That should help them a little bit.
We'll cut down on the paperwork.
Mr. Chair, this has become, I think, local government's mantra here, and I've given them some on that, and I will disagree on this one.
Chair Welsh, I don't, on this bill, the first time we heard it, there hasn't been anybody voiced any opposition at all on it, neither the cities, counties, and we worked out, the only folks that voiced any opposition was the department, and we sat down with Mr. Rindy and Mr. Bland and worked out the amendments.
Well, I could give a quick chance to defend himself, coming from local government to speak for him, but I don't see it either. So.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to clarify that our opposition was really only over technical language. We are very strongly in favor of having clear and objective standards, and I think that's what this is all about.
Gives us something to go on here. Art, did you want to say anything? Thank you.
I agree.
That's me approved.
I moved the dash 3 amendment to 3410.
That's me approved. Move last 3 amendments to House Bill 3410. Any discussion? Hearing none. Any opposition? Hearing none. So,
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3410 as amended to the floor with the DUPAS recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 3410 as amended to the floor with the DUPAS recommendation. Any further discussion?
Yeah, I'd just say for the record that if by the remotest chance a fiscal does show up on this that could be dealt with on the Senate side, I seriously doubt it.
Okay. Any opposition? Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Having required number of votes, it's cool. 3410, pass the floor. As a minute. The due pass recommendation and Representative Morgan will carry. There is one last piece of business. Chair has received a notice of possible minority report coming from Rusty Merkley and Devlin on the House Bill 2838 for the record.
Are you leaving me out of it?
Okay. And
Lori would like to.
Before we do, we can put in.
All right. Okay. She's
out. We're closed. That's now 3:14. Have no further business.
Oh.
I must say I shot for 4 o'clock and sorry in 6 minutes past.
Yeah,
we worked hard. Yeah. Thank you.
We did that one here.
Thank you for all the good listeners. That's a quick name. Have a good week. We adjourn for the day.
Do this, family.
Nice.